Commissioner Spiel, and then we're going to come to you. Okay. All right. Welcome, everybody. Sorry to be delayed a little bit. We appreciate your patience this morning, and aren't you glad it's not a bright, sunny day? So wouldn't you rather be here in the Capitol anyway?
No.
Like, no. Well, Senator Cruz, I think you had an opportunity yesterday afternoon to get outside a bit.
We did some investigative work.
Yes. And which golf course were you at?
One to be disclosed at a later date.
Okay, thank you. All right. We're going to, my understanding is that we don't have any House members here on HCR 13, but I'd like to go ahead and move that forward this morning, and then Senator Walker's here, so we will move, at least have a conversation about the bill that she's here on, which is 2263. So let's open a public hearing and work session on HCR 13. Is there anyone wishing to testify on behalf of the former Representative Max Sumner? Not seeing any volunteers. Senator Farioli, any comments?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. I did attend at least a part of the floor discussion of the bill before us, and it was quite moving. Virtually every member who worked with Representative Sumner rose in remembrance of his work, of his contributions, of his service in the military, of his lifetime in Malala, of his deep affection for the process. And it was just a really nice opportunity for people to remember what a wonderful gentleman was Max Sumner. So I think if you just take a look at the number of sponsors and take a read of the House concurrent resolution that's been crafted by his colleagues, that's really the best tribute that we can offer. And I think that it's altogether fitting that the Senate join in this House concurrent resolution.
Thank you. Other comments? Thank you, Mike, very much. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I would move House Joint Resolution 13 to the floor with a very strong due pass recommendation.
Senator Farioli moves ACR 13 to the Senate floor with a heartily do endorse recommendation. Any further discussion? And thank you for your comments. Any objection to that motion? Hearing seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I might recommend that Senator Beyer carry it.
That'd be great. We will give this to Senator Beyer to carry. All right. Let's go back up to a work session on House Bill 2263. Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us what we have, and Ms. Walker, come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2263, one of the major provisions is that it abolishes summon cam. Other pieces of the bill that's in committee right now require nationally normed tests for 10th graders. You do have a 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20 amendment, and we just received the -21 amendment.
Senator Walker, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and I have with me the trustee, Cindy Hunt from Legislative Council, who worked very hard to bring together all of the amendments that I believe you will need for this bill in the B-21. With your permission and the work of some creative staff, what you have in the B-21 is Senate Bill 757, which establishes a board of directors for the School of the Blind and the School for the Deaf. And that bill left my committee on a unanimous vote and went to Ways and Means, and Senator Cruz serves on my committee. But this, more importantly, this reflects an agreement that I reached with the Department of Education. The Department of Education did not like the task force in the original bill. So that has been removed. I also removed a provision that requires Senate confirmation of the board appointees that the governor appoints, because these boards need to get up and running by the school year coming next. So, and I also, as you know, the reason that you have the bill before you is I got irritated in the Ways and Means Subcommittee when I was not allowed to make a change to a budget note regarding the School for the Blind and School for the Deaf. And so this bill had come back to my committee to fix a problem with the testing amendment. And so at that time, we inserted an amendment that required the legislature to sign off on the superintendent's decision to co-locate or sell the schools. That created some concern by people in this building and by the superintendent, so my agreement was to remove that, and that is no longer in this amendment, in this bill. And then also we have on the very first page of the B21 in lines 14 through 21 is an additional amendment to the testing piece. Representative Buckley had some concerns, and so this is an attempt to address his concerns about allowing students to opt out from the nationally normed test if they so choose. I can represent to you there's significant support for this in the House, so I am not anticipating strong opposition. I'm not sure if it completely meets Representative Buckley's concern, but I think
where is that?
We can be there.
Where is that?
Where is that? That amendment?
No.
In the B21, it is on lines 14 through 21.
But what page?
On what page? Oh, the very first page.
Oh.
I'm sorry. It's already in the bill, the B engrossed bill, that we provide the nationally normed test to all 10th graders, but he wanted to make sure that students could opt out if they wished. Am I correct, Ms. Hunt?
It would be the same as the B16 amendment.
Correct. No, it's the B18.
B18, excuse me. Okay.
Sounds like a bomber.
Thank you, Senator Walker.
Madam Chair, I don't mean to interrupt, but if you would like more explanation about the School for the Deaf or the underlying bill, we can give that to you. But
I guess what I'm I want to go back to the whole issue regarding the testing piece. My understanding is that you have worked with the governor's office, that they are familiar with this proposal.
Yes, Madam Chair, they are very familiar with the proposal. I've worked very closely with Mr. Sager consistently on this bill and many other bills this session, I might add. He's become a fix-it man, which is quite nice. But no, they're aware of this. There was no opposition to this from the ESDs in committee. No one testified in opposition to the testing piece. Other than there was a concern, and that's why we brought the original bill back, that it was not competitive. And now this is competitive and can be open to any contractor, and the department would put it out to bid.
And on the Senate Bill 757 piece, it's my understanding that you and the superintendent have not reached an agreement regarding the funding for that, and that we are going to be looking for funding for that piece as session moves on?
Well, Madam Chair, we've reached an agreement in terms of how we could get the funding down. We've had a long discussion about that, but that funding has not been shown to me where it is.
Okay.
So,
all right.
That's correct.
Other questions, other comments? Senator Vakian?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Either Senator Few or maybe for Ms. Hunt. Page 1, line 16, where it says the department may allow the contractor to waive the assessment. Can you give me an idea of who would constitute a contractor? And I'm guessing that might be a private entity, and why the state would be delegating the authority to a private entity to waive assessments.
Cindy Hunt, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel, Chair Brown, Senator Avakian. An example of, well, the contractor would be the entity that would be administering the exam. So that's an example of the contractor. And the groups of students may be groups of students such as students with learning disabilities who may not be able to take the exam. Or it may be a group of students such as an entire school district that wants to opt out of the exam. That would be up to the department. The reason this is worded the way it is that in Section 42 of 2263, it talks about the department contracting with the nonprofit entity, which is the contractor, to administer to all students in grade 10 who are enrolled in the public school. And I think there was discussions that to administer it to all students was not realistic, that they needed to have some sort of opt-out. Ultimately, it's up to the department, though, how they direct the contractor about waiving the exam for different groups of students. So I don't think there's like a delegation question.
Thank you. Good question, Senator Bakken. Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. And Senator Walker and I have already discussed our differences, but I do want to get on the record. I do have concerns about setting up unique school boards for the school for the deaf and for the school for the blind, only because it costs about $53,000 per student. At least that was what it was in 05, and maybe $61,000 per year for each deaf student. And I know we have 106 deaf students, and about half of them have no disabilities other than their deafness, which many of those students could be mainstreamed if they're in the regular school system, if their parents had so desired. And the 30 students in the blind school are, they cost about $91,000 per year, and there are 30 of those. And I know that those students have multiple diagnoses other than just being blind. And to set up a school board in which there's it takes a lot of tax dollar to run the school, at this point in time, I'm not comfortable in having a separate school board take over that. If we are going in that direction, I would rather have it more of a gradual transition rather than going right out and saying immediately we are going to have a school board for the individual schools. So I'm very hesitant on that piece.
Senator Walker, here's your response.
Oh, I certainly do. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Mona Sanderson. Let me be clear about what the school boards do, because I think maybe you might have the impression that they're taking over the operation of the schools. They are not. The Department of Ed, and that's why the Department of Ed supports this idea. The Department of Ed still has control over these schools. These people have long felt that they have been not treated fairly, that the response from the department on minor day-to-day issues has been delayed. They have been especially upset about the way they've been treated the last few years. And there is a long history with these schools. There's no master plan for the school for the blind or the school for the deaf with regard to their mission. These boards will develop the master plan and the mission for these schools in conjunction with the Department of Education. They will present their master plan to the Legislative Assembly and to the department so that it can be presented to the Ways and Means Committee in the budget hearing process. It's simply allowing them some more control over day-to-day issues within their school. Every school in this state has a school board. And let me just briefly share with you the history of these two schools, because I'm not sure everyone is aware of the rich history. The School for the Deaf was established in 1870, and it had a school board. It was the governor, the secretary of state, and the state treasurer. In 1913 to 1969, it was a board of control comprised of the governor, the secretary of state, and the state treasurer. And they were also, colleagues, required to go to those schools at least four times per year, which some have complained today that that's more than they see of the current direction that they've had. But be that as it may, 1969 to 1971, they were in the Special Schools Division Board of Control, and 1971 to the present, they've been under the State Board of Ed, at least the School for the Deaf. The school, as I said, was founded in 1870, and it ended up at its present location on Locust Street in 1910. The School for the Blind started in 1873, and had a Board of Education, again, the governor, secretary of state, and the superintendent. 1893, it had a Board of Trustees comprised of the same folks. In 1913 to 1969, also the Board of Control, and 1969 to 71, the Special Schools Division, and again, 1971 to the present with the Department of Ed. The school was established at the by the legislature in 1873. It opened at the Salem home of William Nesbitt and then ended up at its present location in 1895. These schools have a long and rich history with this state, and I believe it's only appropriate to allow them a little more flexibility to work with the department and ensure that their voices are being heard like every other school district in this state. It's a very unusual situation that these schools are controlled by the Superintendent of Public Instruction. This department is huge. They have a lot of things to worry about, and these two schools sometimes feel that they don't get the kind of attention that they deserve. This only gives them that opportunity. It gives them appeal rights on two issues and two issues only, and that is the director that's chosen for their school and the co-location issue. They already have appeal rights to the Circuit Court of the State of Oregon, but this gives them appeal rights to the State Board of Ed, and the Superintendent of Public Instruction has agreed with this. We also have put in here that the appeal rights for the co-location of the school would be retroactive to January 1st of this year, so that when the board is up and running, they have 60 days to appeal that decision that was made on May 18th. And the Department of Ed agrees with that. So I don't think these boards are taking over for the Department of Ed. In fact, the department was pretty strong about having to retain control over hiring and firing of individuals, because by statute they're required to do those things. It simply gives them some voice over their own everyday school environment, which I think is extremely fair and generous.
Anything further? Well, yes, and I believe that probably communication should have been a lot better between these schools, and I think that that message has been sent loud and clear to our present superintendent, and I know that she will be far more involved than she has been before. I still would have questions even about the appeal and the co-location, appeals to be able to do that. And I'll leave it at that.
Thanks. Appreciate your comments. All right. Any other questions for this panel? Sarah Cruz.
Madam Chair, just I think more a comment than a question. Because we did fully vet this issue in the Education Committee, and this does not take away the authority of the Department of Ed, but it does give an advocacy and an assistance to the department in moving forward. One of my main concerns is not just the schools themselves, but those students who need the services that can't be in Salem, and some restructuring and some paring down is going to allow those dollars to stretch to cover those students in the far-flung reaches of Oregon who are not getting the appropriate level of services now. So I think this is a move in the right direction.
All right. Sarah Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. This is my bill file on this bill, 757. We had a huge group of people involved in several work groups on this issue, and the department was there. They agreed to these changes. And I have pulled the task force out of the bill. The department felt that the task force would prevent them from trying to repair some of the damage that's been created here with some hard feelings with people at the school. So I have made a commitment to continue to review this issue. Senator Cruz and I are going to meet soon to discuss our committee work plan in the interim, but high on my agenda will be continued looking at these two schools, their governance structure, and what the future holds for them given the co-location. So,
thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. With that, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 2263. We're going to do down to SJR 36. The amendments replace the bill. Ms. Taylor, my understanding is Representative Lim is not available.
That's my understanding, Madam Chair. SJR 36 proposes an amendment to the Constitution, well, the original bill proposes an amendment to the Constitution to recognize the right to privacy. However, the Dash 1 amendment is similar to HJR 15, and it replaces the resolution.
Thanks. Colleagues, as you may recall, because of some, shall we say, antics on the Senate floor, we needed to use HJR 15 for another purpose. So
I don't remember any of this.
I know you don't, Senator Cruz. And so I committed to Representative Lim that we would provide him with another vehicle. This is that vehicle. I think it's good policy. I guess I would ask for your support. Open a work session on SJR 36.
Okay.
You should know as the bill moves to the floor, it will get rid of the requesters, and so the Libertarian Party does not need to support Representative Lim's resolution. So, Senator Cruz, would you be willing to move the Dash 1 amendments?
Madam Chair, I'll move the Dash 1 amendment to SJR 36.
Senator Cruz has moved the Dash 1 amendments to SJR 36. Any discussion? Any vote in opposition? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I move SJR 36 as amended. To the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Cruz has moved SJR 36 as amended to the Senate floor with a do adopt recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. And we'll figure out a carrier later.
Senator Cruz just leaned over and told me he'd like to do it.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Cruz. Thank you, Senator Cruz, for volunteering.
You go pay for that.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's take care of HJR 4. And Mr. Attorney General, I know you're in the room, and we're going to get you on here in just a few minutes. You don't want to be on? Okay. All right. We're going to open a work session on HJR 4. Ms. Taylor, Mr. Hassan, why don't you come forward?
Madam Chair, HJR 4 proposes an amendment to the Constitution to remove provisions relating to qualifications of electors for school district elections in your packet. I also included a photocopy of the portion of the Constitution that would be repealed.
Thank you. I think this is a technical resolution, if I'm not mistaken. Mr. Hassan.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. My name is Elon Hassan for the Secretary of State's office. This was a little glitch in the Constitution that was discovered by the Constitution team, which competes nationally on the federal Constitution, and they were reading through the Oregon Constitution and found that in state school board elections, we required people to be over 21 years or over and to read and write English. Both those policies are unconstitutional under federal law, so this is really a technical change. It's unenforceable, but in the spirit of cleaning up our Constitution, we thought it was a great catch on their part. They've all graduated from high school and are now at PSU and Brown, I believe, the winning team. And they're good kids. It was a good catch, and we wanted to help them out, so we put forward this bill.
Thank you. And I note here that it doesn't amend the current Constitution, which requires every registered voter to be a citizen of the United States.
That's right.
Thank you. Any questions?
Oh, boy. I'm going to let that one go.
Why would anybody vote against that?
All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify? I know this issue was thoroughly.
Madam Chair, the Constitution team of what? Institution.
Yeah. I believe it's Grant High School.
Thank you, Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli. I was really afraid you were going to ask that because it's either Grant or Lincoln High School, and it's Grant High School.
We think it was Grant.
I think it was Grant.
We do not.
It was Grant.
We do not think it was Grant, Madam Chair.
It was.
You know,
it's Grant High School. Thank you, Senator.
Would this be the same Grant High School that the good Senator Ferrioli attended?
In the years, five of the best years of my life.
Okay. Oh, I hope not. All right. Thank you.
One shouldn't mess with a grad alumnus, I don't think.
I don't think so. Okay. Were anybody else wishing to testify on HJR 4? I'm going to open a work session on HJR 4. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, move HJR 4 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Farioli moves HJR 4 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none. So ordered. Did you want to carry this in honor of your school, or do you want
to? Madam Chair, I would love to. Is there any other Grant High School alumnus currently seated in the Senate?
Oh, that's a wonderful trivia question.
I don't know. I don't think so. Happy to do the job.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
That'd be great. All right. Okay. All right. Let's move up to, let's do the Law Commission bill, House Bill 2595. Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us what we have? We have several amendments. Wendy, is this a Sam Sears, or you both of you want to come up? You're here instead of Sam. Okay, come on up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2595 is one of the Law Commission bills that we heard long ago with the House Elections Committee. In your packet, you have the Dash A4 amendment, the A5, the A6. The A4 was at one time Senate Bill 495. The A6 was House Bill 2636. And the A5 allows a person subject to the contested case to request that it be moved to Marion County Circuit Court.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson, welcome. It should be like you should be wrapping up the Law Commission work here pretty soon.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. I'm happy to report that the Law Commission's bills are wrapped up except for the ethics bill.
Okay, great. So we're hoping to help with that.
That would be great. What you have in front of you today is House Bill 2595A. What this bill now represents is a combination of House Bill 2595 and House Bill 2596 with a couple of changes. It has a couple of omissions from the combination of those two bills, namely the area of remedies, what happens when an official is disqualified. That's no longer in the bill. Funding, which is now in Senate Bill 10, and a trust fund provision, which is also now in Senate Bill 10. So those three areas are omitted from this combination bill. And then there are two modifications from the original bills, one running the manual that the GSPC is required presently to publish. The Law Commission had recommended that be distributed more frequently as much as possible. The House changed it to just to suggest that it be done electronically, and so the fiscal did not go up on it. The other change from the way the Law Commission had recommended 2595 and 2596 is in regard to the adjudication process. The Law Commission had recommended a modified opt-out procedure after the commission had found cause to proceed with the administrative hearing. Present law allows for an opt-out by the public official to circuit court. The Law Commission had recommended changing that opt-out so it was not an automatic opt-out to circuit court, but if the GSPC changed its final order authority, leaving the ALJ to make the final order, then the public official could not go to circuit court. The House changed it to a straight APA process, so there is no opt-out to circuit court. You have a one-page summary that lists what's in the bill. Basically, what is in this combination bill is a redefining of the duties and procedures of the GSPC to make it more effective, efficient, and user-friendly. So the bill is really about providing GSPC auditing authority, more rulemaking authority and required rulemaking authority, and also changes the opinions, what the significance are of the opinions from staff and the GSPC. And finally, it does change the adjudication process. The adjudication issue was something that the Law Commission's work group struggled with. The work group also suggests recommended that a straight APA process be used. The Law Commission changed that decision of the work group to the modified approach. The House went back to the work group's original recommendation, which was a straight APA process.
Ms. Johnson, could you just talk a little bit so that folks can understand what the arguments are for and against the opt-out and why this is so critical?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, I'd be happy to explain it as best as I can. Obviously, the advocates for both positions are signed up to testify. The work group discussed this issue at length. I think it's fair to say that the GSPC process in present law is the only one in the state for any agency of this opt-out. Other agencies who have licensing boards and such, it's a straight APA process. You go to an ALJ, and the ALJ has a decision that goes back to the agency, and then the agency can modify that order under certain circumstances, and then it goes to the Court of Appeals. That's the process that this body came up with the Office of Administrative Hearings. The GSPC's process was in statute before the Office of Administrative Hearings was created, so that's part of the reason for the anomaly. Also, public officials have been viewed by some differently than other professions, and there's that view of some that they should be treated differently and have that right to circuit court. It's a policy issue for this body.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Johnson? I think you're going to learn more about the opt-out than you ever want to know, but I think it's a very important discussion. So
I think if you have any questions about the opinions or rulemaking or any of that, this would be the time for that. But I think you heard that testimony when the commission did its initial presentation of all of the bills. We believe all of the changes in 2595 generally are supported without opposition. It's just really this one issue that has the sticking point. Then I'd be happy to answer any questions about the rest of the bill as well.
All right. Thank you. And then amendments as well, if
as those come up.
I assume you're not going anywhere. Okay. Mr. Schradel, Mr. Burson, who else? Why don't we bring up Ms. Ingram?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, Philip Schradel, special counsel to the Attorney General. I'm providing you with written testimony as well, but I'd like to summarize that. I'm going to focus my comments primarily on the opt-out question that you heard Ms. Johnson address. And the Department of Justice is strongly supportive of the Andros version that came over from the House side. And on the House side, the discussion was along the following lines, that the work group of the Oregon Law Commission had given this a substantial amount of attention, and during the process, the Oregon Law Commission had an extended interim process that dealt with ethics issues. And the current circumstance under current statute is that public officials can require the GSPC, if it has determined that it wants to go forward with some kind of an action against that to make a determination whether the public official has violated or not the ethics laws, to refile that in circuit court. That is the current status of the law, and it's the only agency that has that kind of a mechanism that's available and or required. And that process...
Could you just tell us a little bit about why that happened?
Well, it's my understanding that that occurred back in the either 80s or 90s. And at that time, I think there had been some concern about actions of the GSPC. Now, whether those were warranted or not, that was the policy choice accepted by the legislature at the time to afford that opportunity to litigate those in circuit court. The downside of litigating those in circuit court is that it's very expensive, and it really truly affects the GSPC's operating budget when matters can be taken to circuit court. And what that has done, now what has happened and transpired since that point in time was the creation of the Office of Administrative Hearings. The Office of Administrative Hearings has created an independent cadre of administrative law judges that now hear almost all contested case matters for agencies. And all other agencies, there are a few that are accepted from use of the Office of Administrative Hearings, but almost all other agencies use the Office of Administrative Hearings under the Straight Administrative Procedures Act context. And then those hearings are conducted before that independent hearing officer and then go back to the agency for the issuance of a final order. And then those final orders that are issued by agencies are subject to judicial review in a court of appeals, just like all agency matters are. The problem that we have with the current opt-out provision and or any modified opt-out provision, that is, and now it's embedded in Dash A5 amendments that are proposed to this, is that it really changes the locus of decision-making from those that we believe the legislature intends and appropriately should intend to make those decisions. Those are the people of the GSPC, the Government Standards and Practices Commission, that are statutorily charged with implementing and enforcing the ethics laws. If you have the opportunity and or ability to force the matter to get litigated either in a circuit court proceeding or to a final determination by an administrative law judge, what you're really doing as a policy matter is turning that the final arbiter of that either to the administrative law judge rather than the commission or to a circuit court judge. And what you will lose in that process is the expertise that has developed over the years of involvement in the ethics laws of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. They are the ones that are charged with promulgating rules, with ensuring consistency in the application of the statutes. And if you create a system where you have independent ALJs making final decisions, the consistency between adjudications will be harder to maintain. There will be decisions that are inconsistent with each other. And what it really will do is cede the final decision-making to that ALJ. As a factual matter, I believe, and Mr. Burson can address this, there will be direct financial incentive to always cede that final order authority to the ALJ under this modified Dash A5 approach because of the costs that are associated with the circuit court litigation. So as a de facto matter, these matters will then all proceed before final adjudications before ALJs. And what you've really done is turn a system in which you have the statutorily charged entity, the Government Standards and Practices Commission, having to cede its authority to an independent ALJ who's not accountable in the same way that the Government Standards and Practices Commission is. The other pieces of it that were significant to the work group and then to the House, both the House Committee on Elections and the House, which passed the bill unanimously in its engrossed version, with the additional costs associated with it, the efficiencies that would be there, and that there's still more than adequate opportunity for judicial review of these kinds of proceedings under the APA processes. So we strongly encourage adoption of the engrossed version that's come over to you from the House side. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but you might wish to hear from the other
panel members. Let's go to the panel and then do questions. Mr. Burson.
Thank you, Chair. Ron Burson, Executive Director for Government Standards and Practices. Unfortunately, when this discussion took place with the Law Commission and the work group, I came into that discussion late in my position, but I know in those discussions it was talked about there's a perceived idea, there's a view that the GSPC has kind of several chances at making a decision here. In other words, the process has several places where a decision needs to be made, and there was a view that those decisions were final decisions each time. And what I really want to point out is when the GSPC hits one of those decision-making times, in other words, the process, just to go back just a little bit, is this. We actually receive a complaint from the office, and we decide whether to move that complaint to preliminary review. In that decision-making, that's not a decision on whether there's guilt or innocence in this violation. Simply is there enough evidence or is there enough information to reasonably believe that there could be some violation, and should we move it to that next step? In other words, should we move it into this confidential preliminary review process? And that's what the commission is looking at. Once that process is over with, then we make a decision whether to move it into the investigative phase. At no time are we ever making decisions on whether there's any guilt or innocence. In fact, that doesn't happen until after we actually receive either an order back from an administrative law judge, or the person waives that right to go to appeal, and the commission then makes a preliminary finding of a violation. But that is the very end of the process. So I just really wanted to point out that the commission itself is each time one of these decisions is supposed to be made, it is simply making a decision on whether or not there's been enough evidence to move the case forward in the process, but not a decision on innocence or guilt. The other thing I wanted to talk about that Mr. Schradl talked about is the cost with the circuit court is prohibitive, but it's also a cost of time. The circuit court is a much longer time process, and with you look at the front of this page, which are the front of the bill, and we support this bill wholeheartedly. It gives the GSPC reasonable timelines to accomplish the things that it needs to accomplish. But what's kind of different in the bill is that in the statutes, it's asking the GSPC to finish these processes in a finite amount of time by this time. Well, once it actually goes in that circuit court, it could literally be years before this public official could have any kind of final resolution. And that's why we're in favor of the APA, because it's not only less costly, but it's also more time effective, which it seems to be the spirit of what the statutes has asked the GSPC to do when a violation does come before them. So we are in support of this bill, and we're in support of the Angross bill.
Thanks. Ms. Ingram.
Thank you, Chair Brown. I'll be very, very brief. I'm sorry, Genoa Ingram, Oregon Fire District Directors Association. We are just as excited as we can be about this bill, and I just want to take a couple of seconds and tell you why. Probably the main provision of the bill that we support is the ability for the statewide organizations to be able to submit policies to the Government Standards and Practices Commission, and thereby letting us partner with Government Standards and Practices to police our people, and hopefully thereby reducing the cost and workload to the agency. The fire service has worked since the year 2000 on ethics legislation reform, and if this bill passes together with Senate Bill 10, we believe this would be a fine bit of ethics reform. And the best part about that for me is that I could come back in 2008 for the first time in 8 years without having to lobby ethics legislation. With regard to the amendments, we are fine with all of them. We decided to let the attorneys fight about the opt-out. In some respects, it would be nice for local governments to have that option, but we're not going to fall on our swords either way. Just on a personal note, I would very much like it if the name change amendments were included, just because I age myself every time I refer to the Ethics Commission. So just from that vain standpoint alone. From what I can tell, just a quick cursory review, all three of those amendments were embodied in earlier incarnations of the Law Commission recommendations. And with that, I will conclude and say thank you very, very much for hearing this bill.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Sarah Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a ton of questions, but probably not.
You're probably off the hook, Ms. Ingram. Thank you. And we loved your comment. Instead of signing up as for, instead of putting an X, you put yay. So that was sweet.
I have a bunch of questions, but first I'll share what I think is a yogiism. You know, Yogi Berra was famous for making comments that were excruciatingly twisted. Politics is very political. And I think this ethics stuff kind of fits into that situation. Mr. Schradl, when you talked about the history of the opt-out, how deeply did anybody go into the circumstances that led to the creation of the opt-out? And was there some anecdotal justifications, or were there historic citations? Why did we create the opt-out a provision in the first place?
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, again, I wasn't part of that process, but it's my understanding there was some distrust of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. I think your comment that politics are political is exactly right. I think that was a political act to provide public officials with a different process than any other licensed individuals in the state of Oregon are. I think the policy question that for you now is whether there is continued justification or any compelling reason to set up a unique and different system for public officials than for others. The thrust of much of the ethics reform legislation that's before this body this session is to try and bring clarity, understanding, encourage the GSPC to be a vital organization. And I think it's appropriate, very appropriate in that same spirit, to have them governed by the same administrative proceedings as other entities. And the unique circumstances that may have existed, you know, 2 decades ago, I don't think currently exist. Long-winded answer to your question.
Sir. And not the answer to my question, but a great answer. Now, I was really interested in knowing why, and I guess I want to try to back into that from a whole different set of perspectives, if I could have the indulgence of the chair. Are there differences in the rules of evidence between the ADA process or the APA process in the courts?
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli. Yes, the administrative process is very open in the sense that you don't have to meet the same evidentiary standard to have it admissible evidence as it would be in a court proceeding.
Okay.
Now, that means that more information can be, you know, presented by the public official charged as well as the staff. There's just more information that can be made available. The process that the Government Standards and Practices Commission uses now and would continue to use is a bit different than other procedures that might apply in other circumstances because of the preliminary review phase and the investigatory phase. And it's my understanding that those have been engendered some time ago primarily to give the public official charged with an opportunity to have things play out without a tremendous amount of publicity about them, because those are confidential in nature. And, you know, because of sometimes, again, hearkening back to your politics as political comment, there are opportunities for people to use charges against public officials in a political way. And that's why those additional procedures, I understand, were put into place. I don't think those play out at the time that you're actually engaged in the ultimate determination about the basis or lack of basis for the charges that were initially sought.
Madam Chair, I think that gets to the answer that I was after, which is yes, the rules of evidence are different in the APA process than they are in the judicial process. And I appreciate the additional concept that it's possible that these proceedings before APA could be politically motivated. And regardless of whether the hearings are closed in the APA process, certainly the media gives great exposure to those things. So can you discuss a little about the burden of proof on the APA process versus the judiciary process, the judicial process?
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, the burden under the Administrative Procedures Act is always upon the proponent of a fact or position. So if, in order to substantiate allegations that a public official has violated the ethics laws, there would need to be more than a preponderance of evidence or a preponderance of evidence in the record to establish that a violation had occurred. Conversely, if the public official is asserting that there is like some unlawful action that was or it's an unlawful unconstitutional application of a law or something, they would have the burden to establish that. In a circuit court proceeding, a civil litigation, the standard is the same. It's a preponderance of the evidence standard. You don't have to establish guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. But again, the rules of evidence would play out differently in circuit court litigation than they do in the Administrative Procedures Act. And in part, the creation of the Office of Administrative Hearings was to create administrative law judges who would govern development of the record in the administrative process, so that the ALJ develops the record for the process.
Madam Chair, if I could follow that line.
Sure. So,
I'll try to get these on the record, then
okay.
We can move on. So the preponderance of the evidence is the APA procedure, and it would also be the civil procedure. But in the event that criminal charges are proposed, or criminal sanctions are proposed, wouldn't that become a beyond a reasonable doubt threshold?
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, yes, if there were criminal charges that were brought against the public official, but that would be conducted in a different process and different proceeding. That would be brought by a local district attorney's office.
Okay. Where in the APA process is the presumption of innocence?
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, that concept isn't directly embedded anywhere, except that it indirectly is by the fact that the proponent of a factor position has the burden to establish that. So going in, you would need your record developed, would need to establish that. You couldn't have a finding of guilt without any evidence that supported that. And so, you know, essentially, unless the record that gets developed through the administrative process would establish that there has been a violation of the ethics laws, you would not be found to have violated the ethics laws. So in that sense, yes, there's a presumption because there has to be affirmative. There has to be affirmative evidence presented and an affirmative finding made.
Well, I find the conflict in your answer. There is no presumption of innocence. The burdens of proof is on the person bringing the charges. And in some case, that would be the institution, the agency itself.
Chair Brown, Senator Farrell, yes.
Right. And the safeguard there is that the APA process, this agency, which has no obligation for under the presumption of innocence, would bring the charges and then present these charges and the evidence supporting those charges to an administrative law judge.
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, yes, through the administrative process. At the conclusion of that, if anybody thought that an erroneous determination had been made, in the judicial review proceeding, the court would again review that information and find out if the charges had been adequately presented and established.
Let's just touch on, if I may, Madam Chair, the composition of the GSPC Commission. How are they appointed?
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, I'm drawing a bit of a blank off the top of my head, but I think they are gubernatorial appointments that are then subject to approval and confirmation by the Senate. Perhaps Mr. Burson can more directly answer that question.
Yes. Thank you. Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, Ron Burson again. The commission is actually has seven members. Three members are appointed by the governor. Each the House Democrats and the House Republicans each nominate a member, which again is appointed by the governor. And the Senate Democrats and the Senate Republicans each nominate a member, which again is appointed by the governor, then confirmed by the Senate. So the governor actually appoints everyone, but their names are nominated from the House and the Senate, both Democrat and Republican. And they are on for 4 years, and they can only serve one term.
Two terms.
They can serve a term. They can finish up
a former term.
So if they are appointed during an interim, they can finish the term that they started, and then they can be appointed to the next term.
Well, you're kind of looking in your... I think, Mr. Schradl, Mr. Burson, the real issue, obviously, is whether or not we think public officials can get a fair shake in front of this process. And I guess what I'm wrestling with is... why should public officials be treated any differently than anyone else in this whole APA process? And likewise, you know, can public officials, given who they are, how does this not become political? That's really what the issue is, as I see it. One of you want to respond.
I would agree with that, Madam Chair.
Yeah, Chair Brown, in partial response to your answer, I don't know if I can answer it totally, but I don't think there is any compelling reason for public officials to receive different treatment than other licensed individuals in the state of Oregon or any other kind of regulatory action taken by an agency. The Office of Administrative Hearings was created to set up a hearing process that would apply across the board for all kinds of agency decision-making. And it deals with the Board of Medical Examiners, the Nursing Board, licensing and regulatory matters that are a very substantial concern. And there are safeguards that are built into that entire system. Now, I think that Mr. DiLorenzo or others may comment upon the fact that there still is, within that system, the ability of the agency, when it reviews an administrative law judge order, to change that order. And it's certainly with respect to conclusions of law and ultimate determinations, I think that is absolutely important and absolutely vital that the final agency decision maker have that authority. With respect to factual findings, there are safeguards that are built into the system. If there are any changes to factual findings in the administrative process by the final agency decision maker, those are subject to what's called de novo review by the appellate court if somebody wants to challenge that order. That means the appellate court would look at that fresh, anew, without any inference or any deference given to the finding, that they would make their own independent determination of whether the fact found was appropriately found. That has been the process that was worked out under long negotiations that led to the creation of the Office of Administrative Hearings, and it is working. And there's no reason that I can perceive why, you know, the public official process should be treated differently, and certainly no compelling reasons that I find persuasive.
Madam Chair,
I'd submit to you that there are compelling reasons, and that we have not done the due diligence to find those, because we obviously created this opt-out provision under some provocation. So I think there's what I need to do, and perhaps more of us do, is to go back through the history of the provocations that created this push within the legislature to create the opt-out in the first place. And I'm going to do that due diligence. But let me just offer this. It's been said that the cost is an issue. Well, the cost to the agency is an issue. The cost to the people of Oregon is an issue. But let me tell you that the cost to the individuals that are accused of ethical violations is beyond measure. And we've seen some of that play out even in this legislative session. So if we're going to be fair about cost, I think we ought to consider that there is nothing more precious than an individual's reputation. And if we end up spending a little bit more money to make sure that those things are protected, that is something that we owe all existing and future office holders in Oregon. You mentioned that the judges at the Marion County Courthouse may not be experts, but they're not required to be experts in every situation. I mean, we don't expect our judges to be experts. We expect them to be procedurally precise and good decision makers, but they do not have to be experts in every case that they adjudicate. Statewide office holders.
Do you have questions?
Madam Chair, I do have a question.
Okay.
And this is the question I'll leave for the committee. In a circumstance where the accused finds themselves under order to defend themselves against accusations that would be adjudicated by those that already have determined a basis for proceeding, that destroys the presumption of innocence. And in a situation where all of our statewide elected officials and all of the legislative bodies and the executive branch are controlled by one party, where some of those appointments are made, even though we have the right of confirmation in a body controlled by the same party, and even though our caucuses may put forth the names of individuals to serve on these bodies, I think you can make a strong case for the appearance of absolute fairness, or you provide an opt-out provision where people can seek justice in the impartial system of the courts. And either they do that at the front of the process with an opt-out, or they do that at the back of the process with an appeal. So, Madam Chair, I would just tell you that I think there's more due diligence that we need to do to look into the reasons why the opt-out provision was created in the first place, and I think there are excellent justifications to look at an opt-out procedure.
Thank you.
I don't know that was a question. The challenge to the committee is, have we really done our due diligence? That's my
question. Well, Senator Farrelly, we don't have a lot of time to do due diligence, but I really appreciate your comments. I think, you know, certainly I think it's all a question of balancing, and our job is to do that. So any other questions? Thank you very much. I know a number of people. This is a very interesting, scintillating discussion, but Representative Hunt is here, and he's got his daughter with him, so we're going to put him on. So I'm going to close the public hearing on 2595, and my intent on 2595 is to not move the bill today. I want us to move it on Monday. So you have 36 to possibly 48 hours to do your due diligence. With that, I wanted to get as many folks that are here on and the discussion to happen today. Let's open a public hearing on HGR 31. Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us what you've got? Representative Hunt, come on forward. And do you want your daughter to sit at the dais with you?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, H.J.R. 31 proposes an amendment to the Constitution to change the operative date of the legislative redistricting plan to the second Monday of January of the next odd-numbered year after the deadline for developing the plan. And this goes to the next regular general election.
Thank you. Representative Hunt, welcome. I'm so glad that you are here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Long time no see. For the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. HDR 31 is trying to correct a situation that evolves every 10 years in Oregon. And usually by the time we get to the next reapportionment, everyone in the legislature who was there for the last reapportionment is gone. If you'll recall, the way we function right now is there are a whole series of potential take-effect dates depending on how the redistricting actually occurs. If you look through the current statute, it could take effect September 1st, September 15th, November 15th, December 15th. But all of those dates are in the odd-numbered year. And so you have a situation, and the best example, I think, is Representative Phil Barnhart, who in the year 2000 was elected to a district in Eugene. Redistricting occurred. The new districts took effect in 2001. Because he was thrown in a district with someone else, he was assigned to a district that runs from Medford up to Prineville. And then when he ran for election, re-election in 2002, he was elected to a new district that was in central Lane and Lynn counties. But for that year, a little over a year, he represented a district, Phil Barnhart, from Medford to Prineville. Now, I know...
Which is really scary based on what I saw for some of the folks in that area.
Yeah, I know, having talked to Representative Barnhart, that he really appreciated the opportunity to represent Paisley in the legislature. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure the residents of Paisley appreciated him as much as their representative.
Well, and I don't think he visited him, so it was okay.
Senator Cruz.
The core issue here is that we really make... It doesn't change the way we do redistricting. Nothing is the way we do redistricting. It's all about the operative date. And this would change it to basically model the way we already do congressional redistricting. Once it is done, the take-effect date is at the beginning of the next term. So you are elected to a term to represent your district. For that entire 2 years, you are the representative. And then you can run or not run the next time, and then you serve your new district. So instead of having that interim strange year, and there are lots of examples, you know, Representative Carolyn Tomei went from representing Milwaukee to representing Lake Oswego to then representing in the new district, Southeast Portland. It just takes out that middle year. And it doesn't change the process at all of how we do the redistricting. It just changes the operative dates to actually be at the beginning of the next legislative session. And I wish there was a way to do this statutorily. There's clearly not, because our current process is in the Constitution. But it would I think, simplify the process. It would actually save a little money, because instead of having to reprint documents and stationery and everything for that strange interim year, everyone would serve that full two-year term and then have a new district.
Questions? Senator Cruz.
Representative Hunt, this doesn't change. For example, currently, redistricting occurs, Senator is midterm, and they are districted out of the district, but at this point they would still be representing to that midterm point. So how does that factor in?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Cruz, I believe there is a provision here I'm looking for right now that would allow, in that case, the Secretary of State
to
assign a district. But the assignment in that case, instead of happening in the middle of that two-year term, the assignment would happen at the beginning of the next two-year term. I'm looking here specifically. Perhaps your committee counsel can...
Any senator whose term continues through the next regular legislative session after the operative date of the reapportionment shall be specifically assigned to a senatorial district.
Yes, you're exactly right. I skipped right over page one. Thank you, Marjorie. Yeah, so that with the Senate in those unique cases, this would not change that. There would still be an assignment in the case where there is a senator who is redistricted out of his or her district. This would not change the process, that they could still be assigned to a district. The major change would be on the House side, where you have an upset apple cart of lots of people potentially thrown into districts with each other.
Chris. Thank you. And I was one of those. And but I guess I'm just trying. I'm trying to understand. Okay, Senator X is redistricted out of his current district. He's midterm, so he would be assigned to a district. But let's say the district he used to represent, the senator who's also still part of that, is up for election. There's no way. So you could still end up being an odd man out in this thing, for example, because if the senator who has that district is up for election, and the senator who's midterm, who has now been assigned one, would have no ability to run for his seat, his old seat, because somebody else had been elected to serve that seat.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, my understanding is that it does not change that process at all in terms of assignment of Senate seats. It merely changes the operative date of when it would take effect. That's my understanding.
Chris. I guess, Madam Chair, there have been suggestions. I think Senator Deckard had one for setting up a commission to do redistricting and things like that. I wish we were considering that, but.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, Senator Cruz, because I tried to sell President Gene Durfler on that very idea, and it did not meet with much success.
What did you try to sell me?
And Chair Brown, Senator Cruz, I think there are several potential things we might do in changing the way that we do redistricting. This doesn't make judgments on all those potential changes one way or the other. Those could go forward, and we would still have whatever process is arrived at for doing redistricting. We will still have new district lines and need to decide how they are made operative. When.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us this morning.
I appreciate courtesy to me and my constituent daughter.
Who is happily reading something that I'm sure is very good.
Very appropriate. The Magic School Bus.
All right. With that, we're going to close. Oh, anybody else wishing to testify on HJR 31? All right. Close the public hearing. Open a work session. Chair would move HJR 31 to the Senate floor if they do pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objection? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Thank you very much. Senator Bakian, would you like to carry that? This sounds like something very esoteric and right up your alley. All right.
All right, I'm there.
All right. All right, let's go back up to House Bill 2595, DiLorenzo, Thompson, Bishop. John, before you go, Mr. Bishop, are you focused on the entire bill itself, only on the opt-out? Okay. And... I'm sorry?
Section 24.
Okay. All right. Ms. Thompson, and you, entire bill, opt-out, general. Okay, let's take these guys because I suspect you're going to be here for a little bit. So, Mr. Bishop, Mrs. Thompson, go.
Janice Thompson, the group Democracy Reform Oregon, formerly the Money and Politics Research Action Project, so just a little while ago. Just want to convey hearted support for the bill, 2595. I think it really... An ethics agency, I don't think, ever can be or maybe should be, you know, a particularly warm and fuzzy group, but I think this bill includes many, many provisions to make it far more user-friendly. I was going to cite the example that was previously stated by General Ingram in terms of, like, the opportunities for associations to work with the DSPC. And just urge your support for the bill.
Okay. No comments on the opt-out.
Chair Brown, I'm more persuaded by the arguments of the Department of Justice, but overall do not have a big dog in that fight.
Great.
It was interesting to hear this discussed throughout the ethics, you know, work group process, and I guess, you know, this whole notion of vetting, it was thoroughly vetted during that those proceedings.
Mr. Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm appearing in an individual capacity, although I am a member of Harang Law, Jerry Rudnick, an Oregon law firm, and the president of the Oregon Capital Club. I'm not appearing on behalf of either of those. And to my knowledge, we have no clients appearing before the Government Standards and Practices Commission who would be affected by House Bill 2595. I want to focus specifically on provisions in Section 24. Those are the provisions that are identified in the summary of the bill in the highlighted language that says revising provisions relating to commission adjudication process.
Okay.
And the provisions that I'm looking at are page
23.
And I want to make three specific comments about these provisions. These are provisions that affect lobbying and complaints about lobbyists as well as others. There are similar provisions in Section 23 that are pretty analogous, but not exactly the same. And on page 22, line 21, I would like to bring your attention to Section subsection 2B there. It's confusing, I believe. It says, before approving a motion to proceed without a complaint, the commission shall provide notice to the person believed to have committed the violation of the time and place of the meeting at which the motion will be considered. If the commission decides to proceed on its own motion, the commission shall give notice to the person not later than 2 days, 2 business days after the motion is approved. I find that provision confusing because I don't understand how the commission takes action before the commission considers action. It may be that somebody can take action on behalf of the commission, the executive director, for example, or a member of the commission. But as I read this provision, it requires action by the commission before it takes action on a motion. And how they do that, as a practical matter, I think is unclear. It probably requires some meeting of the commission to take action of the commission. And I'm not sure that that step in the process makes any sense. It may well be that Mr. Burson and the commission can figure out a workable procedure to comply with that provision.
They can't hear you.
I'm sorry. It's Saturday. I'm not used to using my Saturday voice. It may be that the commission has enough latitude to figure out how to make that provision workable, but the provision on its face, at least, appears to me unclear. Secondly, in subsection 2C, the commission is directed to give notice of the complaint or motion to a person by mail and by telephone. I don't know who a person is in that context that the commission is required to give notice to. By the drafting of that provision, it appears that anybody can request notice of information when there's been a complaint or a motion on a possible violation. I don't believe that that's what's intended. I believe that that's intended to be to the person who's the subject of the complaint, but that's not the way I read that provision, and it looks like notice could be required to be given to a broader number of persons than the person who is the subject of the complaint. That's important in my view because along with that notice is the disclosure of all materials that the commission will consider at the hearing on the motion. And if that means that all of that information is then in the public domain, mm-hmm. I think that really does open up these proceedings far beyond what is a confidential process
as the bill anticipates and as the current law anticipates, I think, once a matter has moved into the preliminary review phase. But these notice and disclosure requirements, as I read the bill, apply before there's been a determination to go into a preliminary review. I think those provisions will create problems, practical problems for commission and people who submit complaints and are the subject of complaints before the commission. Page 23, line 25, subsection A, this is a provision that references a new and different complaint once there's been a finding of, once the commission has decided to dismiss the complaint or rescind its motion. And it's not clear to me, at least by that drafting, what a new and different complaint is. I assume that it needs to be some sort of allegations of different circumstances than were previously considered. But by only requiring a new and different complaint, that means somebody files something else again, and it appears that the whole process starts over. In the parallel provision on subsequent action by the commission on its own motion, the requirement be that that be based on different conduct. And so for the commission to continue a proceeding, it has to be based on different conduct. For a complaint, it has to be a new and different complaint, but it's not clear again to me what that actually requires. And finally, on page 24, line 23, this is a provision at the end of an investigatory phase when it directs what the commission may do to complete that phase. Line 23 says that it may complete its investigatory phase by seeking or entering into a negotiated settlement. That strikes me as basically prolonging these proceedings forever. At the end of its investigative phase, the commission can then say, let's go into negotiations. And as I read these provisions, there are no limitations then on how long those provisions can last through a negotiated settlement.
So, Mr. Bishop, just in terms of dealing with that on line 23, I assume what you, the direction you would go in is as would be to like reach a negotiated settlement agreement within that 30-day period, right? That's kind of what we're looking
some
for.
Limitation, some
okay.
end, some end time at least for that process, rather than just saying we're going to seek a negotiated settlement. And I think there is a desire to have some time limits and to move these proceedings along quickly. It seems to me that that provision specifically has the potential of prolonging provisions substantially. I think overall these are very important provisions as the committee is trying to come to clear standards, and the commission is going to try to accomplish those too. But I'm not sure that the drafting of the bill, in these respects at least, has reached the point that we have that kind of clarity.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I would really encourage you to work with Mr. Burson and maybe some law commission folks to kind of tighten some of this down. We have a really short, we're on a really short time frame, so I think what I would like to do is bring it back on Monday. So I know you have nothing else to do being a Saturday. Any extent you guys can work this out, that would be much appreciated. So, okay, moving over to opt out. Mr. DiLorenzo.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You guys can go.
Members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner of the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine. But I am appearing here today on my own behalf. I have no clients. I am all alone.
Well, you have lots of clients, Mr. DiLorenzo, but no clients dealing with this issue at this moment in time.
I am all alone. I am David battling with Goliath in the form of the Department of Justice. I am
an advocate of the A5 amendments, which returns the delicate compromise which was negotiated by the Oregon Law Commission. I am also an Oregon Law Commissioner, and I participated intimately in the negotiations and the deliberations that led to that compromise. I am also was intimately involved in advocacy of the opt-out in 1993, and so I would like to give you a little bit of history about why the opt-out took place and how important it is, notwithstanding the fact that I have agreed to the compromise which was in the Oregon Law Commission recommendation. The amendments which I advocate relate to the circuit court opt-out, and ever since the 1980s, one component of my practice has been the representation of public officials before the GSPC. Between the 1980s to the early 1990s, I handled numerous matters before the GSPC, and they would normally proceed with either a complaint or the commission on its own motion deciding to take up a matter, at which time there would be a vote of the commission. At that point, the GSPC would initiate a preliminary review, provide a preliminary review report, and once again take up the matter and yet another vote to determine whether or not to initiate an investigation. Following the investigation, there would be a presentation before the GSPC, and for the third time, they would once again take up the matter and vote again as to whether to initiate a contested case proceeding. So by the time the contested case proceeding was initiated, the GSPC would have voted three times against the public official to go to the next step. They would be functioning pretty much like a grand jury. They would decide that there was evidence sufficient to warrant proceeding to the next step. Now, at that point, a contested case before the commission itself, where the commission served as the prosecutor and also as the judge, could hardly be regarded as a hearing before an objective fact finder, since that fact finder had already found three times to proceed to the next step. That would have been tantamount to having conducted a trial before the grand jury that had brought the charges to begin with the grand jury serving not only as a prosecutor but also as the jury. Although the GSPC commissioners at the time felt that they could maintain their objectivity, even in light of the role as a grand jury and a prosecutor, the client's perception of unfairness was absolutely overwhelming. It was very difficult to explain to a public official how the commission that had voted against him or her three times could then, in a contested case, wear all hats, prosecute, and decide the case fairly. So in 1993, at my urging, the legislature adopted Senate Bill 159. And 159 changed all that. Section 2 of that bill created the circuit court opt-out. After the GSPC determined that it would initiate a contested case, the public official or the person before it could require the GSPC to initiate a lawsuit so that a judge sitting as an objective party could decide the case. Now, since that time, the GSPC has in fact filed a number of lawsuits after having reached the contested case stage. I have been involved in two such suits. To the best of my knowledge, the commission has never won a case having to litigate in court. In essence, that means that the GSPC had publicly found against a public official three times after the public official had been exposed to the derision and the criticism in the press three times, and yet an objective judge had vindicated that public official in the end. If you ask any of my former clients, Republicans and Democrats, whether they felt the GSPC could objectively consider their case under those circumstances, the answer would be an overwhelming, resounding no. Now, in 1999, the legislature adopted House Bill 2525, the Independent Hearings Officer Bill. Madam Chair, you and the members who were here at the time all supported that bill.
Representative Shetterly, Representative Williams, there was a huge group of folks that worked on it.
That's right. And that bill was meant to create at least the appearance of objectivity by separating the prosecutorial function from the decision-making, adjudicatory function. During the Oregon Law Commission's deliberations this summer, the Department of Justice made clear that it was no longer satisfied with the opt-out provision in the ethics law and wanted to revert back to the Administrative Procedures Act because the legislature had passed the Independent Hearings Officer law, and they felt that the proceedings before the commission should be treated just like proceedings before any other agency, and that public officials should not be differentiated from anyone else. I argued quite vehemently as a member of the Law Commission that the circuit court opt-out should be preserved because administrative law judges are not truly independent, given that the agencies whose hearings they preside over can reverse their decisions at the agency's whim. The Department of Justice was unmoved by that argument. At that point, Commissioner Greg Mao, Commissioner of the Oregon Law Commission, proposed a compromise, and I embraced that compromise. The compromise provided that the GSPC could eliminate the right of a public official to go to circuit court if the GSPC were willing to give the administrative law judge final order authority. In other words, if the GSPC were willing to let the ALJ make the final decision, and then if the GSPC didn't like that, they could appeal to the Court of Appeals just like any party before them could. I thought that was a fair compromise. I understood the GSPC's concerns about expense and litigating. All I felt a party before the GSPC wanted was the assurance that they would get a fair shake before someone who was truly independent and whose decisions could not be reversed at the whim of the agency. So we then get to where we are today. Undaunted, the Department of Justice and others convinced the House Elections and Rules Committee to revert back to the DOJ's version, destroying that delicate compromise and eliminating the circuit court opt-out altogether. The A5 amendments that you have before you restore the compromise of the Oregon Law Commission, the one which I just described.
Can I have you summarize the remaining part of your testimony, which is actually quite fascinating, but we're running out of time.
All right. Well, Madam Chair, I will just let you know that this spring I was invited to be a speaker before the Oregon Association of Administrative Law Judges. They wanted me to talk about judicial independence. I spoke of a recent case that I had before an agency whereby we won before the ALJ. The client paid a significant amount of money. We had put on a great case and was overjoyed at the solution. We then went to a hearing before the agency. It was the OLCC to determine whether or not the OLCC would adopt the Judge Rutherford's very well thought through decision. The Department of Justice showed up, argued to overturn Judge Rutherford's decision. Then the agency met in executive session. Of course, the Department of Justice joins the agency in executive session. We can't join the agency in executive session. And all of a sudden, within an hour, the decision of the ALJ is completely rewritten, and we have now lost, and the ALJ has been completely overturned. I asked the ALJs, how often does that happen? And I was shocked to hear at their conference that whenever the ALJs rule against an agency, over half the time agencies reverse the ALJ, and worse yet, they do it because they know that the people before them have exhausted their resources and can no longer continue the fight and will have to now accept the agency determination. All right, now that's a bigger issue than we have before us here, but do you want public officials who are before the GSPC to face that very situation where they put on a great case, they win before an objective finder of fact, the independent administrative law judge, only then to have their decision completely rewritten after they have exhausted all of their resources? Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think this compromise that's been worked out is a great compromise. We should try it. And I think if it works at the GSPC next session, we should consider whether it should be applicable to other agencies. And I thank you. I know I've...
No, I'm just a aha moment, and that is one of the distinctions here, though, I think you would agree with me, is that we have set up the legal defense trust fund piece
so that public officials will not have exhausted resources, unlike under other individuals using, I mean, assuming everything you say is correct, the difference here is that at least under Senate Bill 10, we have a legal defense trust fund that at least provides for the opportunity of non-exhaustion of resources.
Madam Chair, that's true, but in practice, if someone has already been convicted in the press, and if the GSPC has overturned the decision of an ALJ, whether members of the public will be prone to contribute to that defense fund, I think is certainly questionable. But you're right, in theory, that's correct. Notwithstanding that, all we are concerned about is being able to have the perception of a fair shake. And under the system proposed by the Department of Justice, the GSPC has the final word, and if they don't like the ALJ's determination, too bad. They'll change it.
Question, Sarah Rockin.
Thanks. If you were to do this with a bench trial at a circuit court and the judge is the trier of fact and makes the decision as well, explain to me what the difference is between the independence of the commission to determine facts and draw a conclusion and the circuit court. Why do you consider one to be objective and one not?
Madam Chair, Senator Avakian, first of all, a circuit court would not have been party to all of the reports by all of the investigators leading up through the process. I don't think anyone would ever suggest that a grand jury, for instance, who had brought an indictment, should then be the jury that sits in judgment ultimately on the trial. That's the first problem. The GSPC has this case over and over and over, proceeds to the next step, the next step, the next step, and also acts as a prosecutor because they're legal advisor actually prosecutes the case before them. I think it is a completely different circumstance.
I don't know. I think that certainly it wouldn't be, the as your example, the grand jury proceeding that dictates what the judge would do. Certainly all the supporting evidence that would have led to an indictment would be presented at the circuit court to substantiate the charge or negate it.
Madam Chair, Senator Avakian, in addition, the rules of evidence don't apply at any of those preliminary phases. Hearsay, double hearsay, triple hearsay is all admitted, all considered by the GSPC at any point. There are no procedural safeguards. In fact, one of the advantages to litigating in court is that the person who is defending the charge has the right to subpoena witnesses. You know, in a GSPC proceeding, you have to ask the GSPC for permission to issue subpoenas.
Just one other question, and then I'm done.
Senator Brockin.
I think when we get to the rules of evidence argument, that's an interesting one. But in this state, we would go so far as to revoke a person's professional license and kill their career without the rules of evidence.
That's correct.
And I'm guessing that you don't think we should change that.
Well, Madam Chair, I believe what we need at all agency levels and through the APA is final order authority for ALJs.
Okay.
That's what I really think is important. And I think what's important is the perception of fairness, too. You know, from the perspective of the person before that agency, they ought to know that they're going to get a fair shake and that the prosecutor is not going to decide their case.
I have to give Mr. DiLorenzo at least credit here that he is at least consistent, and I guess what I'm troubled by is the fact that we would, I think you can make some distinctions, but at least, you know, for any of us who would be involved in the Ethics Commission process, you know, certainly we have, it certainly damage or finish our careers, but that is no different than folks involved in the other licensing board processes. And so I guess what I'm troubled by is that we would treat public officials differently than you would treat physicians or other folks out there.
Well, Madam Chair, let me address that then. And, of course, this comes from experience, having been involved in a number of very high-profile GSPC proceedings. The attention by the press and the intensity of being in the fishbowl is absolutely overwhelming when you are dealing with a public official and a GSPC proceeding. And no real rules of evidence
and anything coming in to the record. I can tell you that it is 5 times to 10 times the intensity as one experiences when you have just an ordinary licensing circumstance, which of course is important to the person before them, but is not being covered in the news every day. And so the intensity alone and the public nature of the proceeding so far outweighs a normal APA proceeding that I think it certainly justifies treating it a little differently. The other main justification, though, is I think this compromise that's been reached by the Oregon Law Commission deserves a shot. Consider this an experiment. See if this works. If this works, where an agency actually has to give final order authority to its ALJ who decides the case, let's see how it goes. If it goes well, let's then extend it to other agencies. So I think what we have before us with this Oregon Law Commission compromise is a marvelous opportunity to try that. Those are the two reasons why I would do it.
Quick comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that there's some hesitation to treat people in the legislature or elected public officials in a different manner than others. But I'll just propose that if we were to take this step and give the hearings of officers final order authority, we should do it with legislators and elected public officials first and see if it works. And essentially hold it up as a higher standard, because what you're saying is that the procedure comes to a final order, and then and only then would you then have access to the court system.
Sure.
So to me it seems like if there is an improvement to be had here, the best guinea pigs, in fact, are the ones seated behind this dais.
All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2595. I guess my earlier inclination was to be bring this back first thing Monday morning. I think it's extremely important for both caucuses to spend some time on this issue. So I would shoot at least for later Monday afternoon. But we need to move this bill. So we need to make some decisions. So please, folks, let's. This is a very interesting discussion. And extremely important. Okay, close the public hearing. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2082. We've seen this multiple times. Ms. Taylor.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2082 is the initiative reform bill. You have the 15 amendment that includes the provisions from the dash 7s, 9s, 10s, 12s, and 13s that you've seen previously.
Okay.
Briefly, I know Mr. Day had a process change on the ballot title issue. I don't necessarily disagree with him. I just think we could not move forward on that given the time frame. I know that there are folks in the Secretary of State's office who are interested in working that through the interim and possibly bringing something back in February of 2008. So that would be my comments in terms of those particular pieces. Senator Farrioli.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I agree completely. The issue isn't going away. There's no sense that we would be making final resolution to this issue ever. You know, the democracy is alive and thriving, and direct democracy is one that will be always hotly contested by people all across the spectrum. I would urge that the chair create a work group on H Bill 2082 and SB 125 and have those folks challenged significantly to come up with something before February 08.
Okay. The chair will actually request the Senate president to put this on the agenda item list for the interim, so in terms of follow-up. So with that, we're in work session on 2082. I would move the dash A15 amendments. Discussion. Krista, please call the roll.
Senator Cruz.
Aye.
Senator Montana.
Aye.
Senator Bakken.
Aye.
Senator Perry.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Chair would move the bill as amended with the dash 15 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Comments. Senator Farrioli.
Yes, ma'am. Vote explanation.
Sure.
This issue is of such importance, I would just simply advertise and reserve the right to take this issue up with my colleagues and reserve the right to change my vote on the Senate floor if that becomes an issue.
Totally fine. Senator Cruz, same would apply to you if you would like.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I agree that we may never finish with the subject. Clearly, I'm not sure that this fruit is ripe enough to be moving forward.
Your analogy is a good one for some things, but not for this one. All right. Krista, would you please call the roll?
Senator Montes Anderson.
Aye.
Senator Bakken.
Aye.
Senator Farioli.
Aye.
Senator Cruz.
No.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. I'll carry this little fruit, shall we say. and with that, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 125. This is the second or third time we've had public hearings, so I'm going to invite the Mr. Meek, Mr. Wasson up with the request that you keep your comments relatively brief. We're going to move forward, and you're still going to have another chamber to battle this one out on. And since time, I guess what I would tell you is time is on your side. Thank you. Not today, but I think for the rest of the time.
Thank
Go
you,
ahead,
Mr.
Meek.
My name is Dan Meek. I represent the Coalition for Initiative Rights. This bill enables the legislature substantially greater control over the initiative process and allows the legislature to cause ballot titles to be changed for measures that the legislature or legislators don't happen to favor. It's another means for the legislature to exert a controlling influence over the initiative process by in the even-numbered year session, changing the laws that are the subject of measures that are already on the street and already have ballot titles. Let me give you an example. Let's say that we were on the street with a measure to create a system of public funding for campaigns for candidates for the legislature. And let's say we already had all the signatures collected by the time the even-numbered session starts. In the even-numbered session, let's say the legislature adopts a unworkable system of public funding, or one that provides $1 of public funding, or one that starts in the year 2032, or in other words, is a system of public funding that is not satisfactory to the sponsors of the initiative. Under this bill, the ballot title would then have to change for the measure, even though all the signatures have been collected. Let's say that the caption stated, create system of public funding for campaigns of candidates for the legislature. But since the legislature would have then adopted something in the meantime, it would have to change to alters or changes existing system of public funding for candidates for the legislature. So this gives the legislature an opportunity. I don't know if it would be used or not, but it gives the legislature an opportunity to significantly change ballot title captions, even if the legislature does not significantly change the underlying law. So I would be very trepidatious about this measure.
So, Mr. Meek, wouldn't the reverse be true as well, though, that you could have a ballot title, a measure going to the ballot, that there's been significant changes to Oregon law, but the ballot title would not reflect, and I actually can't think of anything off the top of my head, but that the ballot title and the measure change would not significantly reflect the ballot measure?
Chair Brown, yes, I understand that. There are some changes that could be made to the bill. For example, you could put the burden of proof on those who are advocating a change to the ballot title, as opposed to allowing the Attorney General to change the ballot title and then placing the burden of proof on everyone else to show that change is not substantially accurate. You could require or limit the opportunity to change the ballot title only if the caption becomes substantially inaccurate. This bill allows changes to the ballot title if the caption or the yes or no questions become substantially inaccurate in the opinion of the Attorney General. And that opinion in itself under this bill is not subject to judicial review. There's judicial review if the Attorney General says, I don't think there's been a substantial change here, then the person who files the complaint gets judicial review. But if the Attorney General says, I think there is a substantial change here, that decision is not subject at all to judicial review under this bill. Perhaps you could also, instead of changing the ballot title caption and yes or no questions, put a note in the summary about a ballot title summary about what the legislature has done in the interim. So there are other ways to approach it. But this certainly would tend to give the legislature a very significantly increased amount of control and controlling influence over the initiative process.
Senator Farioli.
Can you, Mr. Mead, can you envision situations where opponents or proponents of the ballot title would bring intense pressure on the legislature to enter into that issue? In other words, are we going to get sucked into this stuff, or are we going to be compelled by constituents to rewrite ballot titles?
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, I'm sure that you could answer that question better than I could about the pressures that legislators are subjected to. But if there's a measure on the street, particularly one that for which the signatures are already collected, that that people are very interested in, no doubt you will hear from your constituents about that. And one way to derail such a measure is to make a change to the law that is sufficient to cause the ballot title to change, even if the change to the law in and of itself is not significant.
I guess, Mr. Meek, this is more of a comment than a question. I think I hear you saying that this gives the legislature more control in terms of the initiative process. We actually have control over statutes, and this doesn't change that. What it does is provide for a process when the legislature does change statutes. And, frankly, in terms of the protections, et cetera, the legislature is not really involved in this. I mean, it's the Attorney General. The last I knew, he was an independently elected official. So that would just be my comment for the record. Let's turn it over to Mr. Wasson and go from there.
Greg Wasson, representing the Committee for Petition Rights. Both the legislature and the Attorney General are part of the government.
No question.
And
and so are the people.
When someone in Prineville has something happen to them, they don't say, well, the Attorney General did this to me, or the courts did this to me. They say the government did this to me. And so I that distinction, while maybe technically correct, I don't think politically is very correct. My comments are about both this bill and 2082, which was just approved, I think are both attempts to make the initiative process unusable or repeal the initiative process by chipping away at it. And I would just remind the committee that, in case they don't know, that when the initiative process was adopted, amendments to the Oregon Constitution had to be approved by two successive sessions of the legislature and then went on the ballot. The fact that the initiative was able to clear that extremely laborious process and then get approved 11-1 is evidence of just how bad the system was without the initiative. I went to a Grateful Dead concert in the city of Eugene, where the city of Eugene said, hey, this thing's going to happen. So rather than picking at the people who are going to be there, let's just embrace it. And it worked beautifully. The city of Eugene made a whole lot of money, and the people who were going to the concert didn't get hassled unnecessarily. And I think that this legislature should adopt the same process or the same feeling about the initiative process. The thing is here, and it's necessary, so instead of making little nips at it, let's embrace it and make it work correctly. And that's...
Questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Meek, did you want to add something else?
If I may, thank you. On HB 2082, are you? May I ask if the committee is only adopting the -15 amendments and not the -7?
That's correct. They the 15s adopted incorporated the 7s.
I don't see them in the 15s.
One of the pieces that you had concerns about, I think, was already in the amendment itself.
The part of the -7 amendments was to correct the House bill which had left in, inadvertently left in the requirement that the electronic template be two-sided, that it have a cover and a reverse side.
Hey, on line 4.
Line 4 of?
15. On page 3, delete 38 and insert 250045.
Thank you very much.
Five. Okay.
it wasn't in bold.
I know. It's hard to read. Okay, good. Panic. All right. Thank you. Appreciate you raising that. All right. Anybody else must testify on Senate Bill 125? Two comments. Come on up, Mr. Tradel.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, Philip Tradel, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. I simply wanted to point out for the committee that there were two changes from the A3s.
Yeah.
On the first one's on page 1. It used to just say statutory law. Now it says Oregon statutory law, so it would narrow it to just matters undertaken by this legislative assembly that affected the ballot title. And the other thing, working with Ted Reitlinger, we clarified there was a concern raised by Mr. Day that the certified ballot title that was issued by our office would have to be the ballot title that was used in the voter's pamphlet, even if the Supreme Court certified a different ballot title. We've cleaned that up. Language that used to be in 4 little c eliminated, and there's new language on page 4 in section 14 that clears that up. So the Supreme Court certifies a different ballot title, that's the ballot title. So those two clarifications were made with working with legislative counsel.
Thank you. Mr. Hassan? Questions? All right. Anybody else? All right. That will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 125. Open the work session. Chair would move the -5 amendments to Senate Bill 125. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, I like the original bill.
Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Well, I do too. I like them better with the -5s, though.
Okay.
No, that eliminates
all
the
original
bill.
All right, you
bill.
Two. Krista, call the roll.
Senator
Watkins?
Aye.
Senator
Perioli?
No.
Senator
Monk? Aye. Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Chair would move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation. Please call the roll.
Senator Perioli?
No.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Senator Monk?
Aye.
Senator Watkins?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. All right, Senator Farioli.
Chair, I would move that we reopen the public hearing on HB 2082 for the purpose of a motion to accept a change of vote.
Thank you. Senator Farioli is asking for unanimous consent to open a public hearing or a work session on House Bill 2082.
Having been on the prevailing
having
side.
Been on, well, I think it's actually a rule suspension.
The rule suspension.
For House Bill 2082 to bring the bill back for us. Any objection to that motion? Hearing seeing none. So ordered. Senator Farioli.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to change my vote on House Bill 2082 from yes to no. It will not affect the outcome.
Okay. Senator Farioli has asked to change his vote since the bill is back before us to from a yes to a no on House Bill 2082. It will not affect the outcome, and he's committed to me he will not do a minority report on the issue, and we appreciate that.
Not at this time.
You have enough vehicles to do minority reports. I know you guys are running out of really good ideas.
We will never run out of really good ideas. But Madam Chair,
I did not mean to say that.
Madam Chair, for the record, thank you for acknowledging that they are really good ideas.
Senator Farioli, how do you vote on House Bill 2082?
No.
All right. Noted for the record with that, the motion still carries and the bill will be moving to the Senate floor.
And before we adjourn, thank you very much.
We're not adjourning. We're going to take a, do you need more than 5 minutes on that other issue?
On this issue, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Probably about 10.
Okay.
But
we'll
no
be back. We'll be back at 12:23, which means no one will be back here till 12:25. So we are in recess till 12:25.
Okay.
Thank you. 6-3, Ms. Taylor, please refresh our recollections.
I'm not on the
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, the 2263 is the bill that would abolish the SimCam. At least that's one of the major provisions, and you had the B-21s.
We've been through a number of amendments. We're in work session. The chair would move the B-21 amendments to House Bill 2263. Discussion.
Yeah.
Senator Montana.
Just a comment. And I was out in the hall and was given
some of my fears have been waylaid, but I do want to put on the record, I will be voting for this amendment, that I am a little concerned about the structure of who will serve on the board, but my fears are waylaid in a sense because the governor will be appointing, and for some reason that did not register, because regular school board members are elected by the public, and we truly need members who are going to be very vested in these boards if they serve on them. And I do not know what the parents are like of these, but again, I looked and it doesn't have to be a parent serving on these boards, and so
And Sarah Monahan, yeah. I just have to say I really appreciate the unique perspective that you bring to these particular issues on this. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
So.
Well, my sister is deaf, and she actually attended the school for the deaf, and so her perspective is very different on some of these issues, so that's who I've been getting my information from, because she was a student there in the 60s for a very short time and has a very different perspective, but she has a lot of contacts with the deaf people here in the state of Oregon. And believe me, even though she lives in New York, she knew all about what was going on with the school for the deaf. I mean, that community is extremely close. And so I just have a different perspective, but it's coming from my sister.
Sarah Ferrioli.
Yeah, I'm sure. In the same way that the Board of Trustees appointed a hearing president for Gallaudet University, which I think the appointment lasted about 2 weeks, this community is very well activated and connected, and I think any of the appointments that would be put forward by the governor would be well vetted in that community and would have to have nearly universal support.
So, thank you. Thank you, Sarah Ferrioli. Anybody else? All right, the motion was to approve the -B21 amendments. Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Chair, we move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. That was with the -B21s. We have a little resources issue that we're going to need to take care of as well, so I want everyone to be aware of that. Any other discussion? And I appreciate you guys. I know this has been there are a whole lot of pieces that is coming from different places, and appreciate your cooperation and patience. So any other comments? Any objection to moving the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered, and Senator Walker carry the bill. And that's it. I think we're done for the day. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We'll be back Monday afternoon, I'm guessing. With that, we're adjourned.